the chorus? Do the chorus? All right. You're 3 weeks late with
yeah.
Well, song. That's you're too literal minded.
All right.
Quit hogging the mic that we're sharing today because we have a guest, but we'll get into that in a second. No, 2 weeks ago, you know, Dave and I had a big argument about the song that I picked and how he hated it and how I'm terrible and blah, blah, blah. So this week I thought, all right, what's a song that no one hates?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Good call.
That's a song that no one hates.
Nobody hates that
good
song.
Call.
Nobody hates that,
that
song.
That is a fact. Nobody yes. hates that song.
And there's another story to tell about that music argument, but first we want to introduce our very special guest
hang
today.
Hang on.
Oh, we ourselves, I suppose, will be good.
This is Linoleum Knife.
Oh, yeah, that too.
That you are listening to. It's a podcast about movies.
About the cinema.
Ugh.
It is about...
Pick one.
The cinema.
He started up with the cinema business.
Look,
that was not me.
When I'm in the room, the conversation gets heady. I'll have you know. We talk.
Eddie Lamar.
I'm a cineast, a cinephile.
Right.
I'm no joke.
Right. You have glasses now.
I have reading glasses, and that means
like
I'm
all cinephiles,
10 times soon smarter than I was before. About everything, including film language and all the theories and stuff about that.
I hear the language of cinema is universal.
It's not.
Oh, my
Lanta. Only some people know it, and it's us smart people.
Fine.
So, anyway, I am Dave White of Movies.com. I'm the film critic for Movies.com. You're Alonzo Duralde of...
What?
Say it.
TheRap.com,
right.
And the YouTube program What the Flick.
Okay, so now we can introduce our guest.
Okay.
Who is...
Don't lead with the podcast, as I haven't made one in 1,000 years.
Why, how long has it been since you've
it's
done
been
one?
It's been a long time.
How many long times? Since us? Were we the last people on
no,
your podcast?
There was maybe one after you, but wow. That was it, yeah.
So we're still up at the top of the queue when people go to your
absolutely.
Page or whatever?
Absolutely.
Which, did it just feel like an exercise in futility to keep going after we were done with your podcast?
Honestly,
like, were we
no,
so
it
great?
Has to do with my co-host, Matt Cohen, who is, as we speak, on a flight to Japan. Cohen wrangling. Between guest wrangling and Cohen wrangling.
That's a lot of wrangling.
It's too much.
But
yeah,
also because
too much
we were too great.
All right.
It's true. Just go out at the top.
All right. Well, then we will. Then your first cred gets to be you are co-producer.
Yes, on this the weekend bomb, the Fifth Estate. How could we have known? We could not have known while we were scheduling this podcast that the film would open to near universal critical acclaim and startling box office success.
Let's just say that your opening weekend set records.
Exactly. Well, I believe we are the lowest grossing DreamWorks movie ever made.
Wow, okay.
Lower even than the Sinbad cartoon thing from the 90s.
Starring Sinbad?
If only.
No, I think voiced by Brad Pitt.
Yeah, Brad Pitt.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, co-producer of The Fifth Estate.
Did it make less money than a Sinbad movie, though?
Yes.
And any, like, a movie that stars Sinbad?
It's within spitting comedian? Distance. No, just the DreamWorks animated Sinbad.
Yeah,
first kid or something?
Say,
yeah,
exactly. I see what you're saying. I'm trying to follow the bouncing Sinbad.
The child
here.
In the White House.
Exactly.
Those, yeah.
With Sinbad
first
as the
kid.
Bodyguard. Was
right.
that? What was that? Was it called First Kid?
I think it was called Olympus Has Fallen.
I saw that movie.
There's some pederasty involved in one of those White House kid movies.
Really?
I'm trying to think.
Gross.
Somebody went to jail.
Did what's his face powder guy make one that we don't know about?
No.
Yeah, it was called First Kid.
Victor Salva. That's it.
No.
Okay.
It was called First Kid. 1996's right. First Kid, starring Sinbad.
You saw every kid movie of the late 90s because you were taking children
of all the 90s
because he was paid to see them.
No.
No, not even that. He
this
was volunteering.
When I was a school
them.
Teacher, but I volunteered at an AIDS hospice.
Okay.
On the weekends, and there were all these kids. who lived there with their parents. Their parents had AIDS, and the kids did not, and they were bored
in the
because
city
their parents were sick Dallas.
Got it.
So my job every Saturday was to get the 18-seater van. And I learned how to drive that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a boss now.
I didn't doubt it.
That. And I took every one of those damn kids to the movies every Saturday.
Wow.
And there was like 12 of them.
So, so that whole, you we saw all the Free Willy sequels.
Everything.
So there are 12 kids who are all cineasts.
Exactly.
Three ninjas kicked back.
And they had heady conversations.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, we keep
kids, let's talk about Bailatar.
Our guest today is Jack Morrissey.
Yes.
Yay.
That's Alonso clapping and Dave slapping his table.
Also,
I've got a cup of tea in my hand.
The host of the sporadic yet riveting Team Jack podcast.
And your autobiography came out this week.
Oh, where's this going?
No, that was the other Morrissey.
About all the
oh yeah, and
from your perspective about the split with Johnny Marr,
bitching about that in UK. I read a piece in the Guardian this morning about that.
Aaron's got his copy coming in the mail. I'm going to borrow it when he's done reading.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
What are they saying in the Guardian?
Just that he's ruined everything. That he hasn't been relevant since forever, at least over there.
I think about him every day.
Do you really?
I do.
What do you think?
I love him so much.
Morrissey?
Yeah.
Stephen Morrissey?
Yeah.
Not Jack Morrissey.
You're fine.
But Stephen.
But, yeah.
When he broke...
Every day is like Sunday, Dave.
when he broke, were you like, ugh. Like you just knew you were going to get saddled with that the name?
No, my Morrissey story is I don't think I had any awareness of him until we moved to suburban St. Louis the summer before my senior year of high school, and I started listening to one of two radio stations at the time in the world that were owned wholly by the YMCA.
Oh, wow.
And the only one owned by the YMCA in North America. And so what the YMCA of West County did was they turned that radio station, 89.7 KYMC, over to high school kids from Parkway West High School, which is a very Hughesian high school and a very Hughesian suburb during the age of Hughes.
Right.
Where that meant something. And they would let these, I think there were one or two grown-ups involved. It's a bit like a cross between Pump Up the Volume and Empire Records.
Nice.
There was some mentor figure, but mostly the station and the programming was in the hands of these high school kids. And these high school kids, at the time... furthermost suburb of St. Louis, we're into all of this music that now has become synonymous with radio on most radio stations, none of which was being played at the time on Top 40 radio, which was still very much alive and well.
Right.
And so on KYMC, I heard How Soon Is Now for the first time by the Smiths. And then I started to, obviously I turned on a lot of the Smith stuff and then the Morrissey stuff flowed in. I never really connected or related to it that much. Probably,
yeah.
It didn't, I mean, I'm 46 now.
There would be no reason.
16 or 17 then, so.
Yeah.
But then I saw him at a sort of K-Rock Inland Empire invasion thing of a few years ago at what was the Glen Helen Pavilion out in the IE.
Right.
And I got it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, what an amazing presence and what an amazing performer. And obviously here in the States, he has since reinvigorated his listenership with hundreds of thousands of Latino sort of gangsters.
Kind of, yeah.
Right, and he's writing to them now with
yes.
songs like I think Hector was the first in his gang to die.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and he toured,
and
with,
it's incredible.
With Los Aguanes
and everything. Yeah. Yeah, no, he knows.
He knows where his pan is buttered.
Yeah, but boy, is it buttered! I mean, he sells out,
yes.
And he'll when he comes through Los Angeles,
he'll do five nights.
He'll do the Bowl.
Yeah,
he'll do the Palladium. Then he might do Nokia or Staples,
right.
And they're all selling out.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and when you go, it's a sea of black, Hispanic, black pompadours.
Yes.
Mm.
Held up with more hairspray than...
It's fantastic.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Well, no, it's funny. You were talking about the what they were playing then and what everybody's playing now. The conversation always comes up when we see a movie like Hot Tub Time Machine or something, one of those 80s retro movies where frat boys are dancing to New Order. It's like,
No. Frat boys had never heard of New Order.
That did not happen.
Yeah. They were listening to Mr. Mister.
Correct.
But what's interesting is how much of that music that was parked at or near the top of the charts during that decade now really has just been moved over to sort of easy listening for middle-aged folks like ourselves.
Yeah.
But does not, you don't hear it in restaurants, you don't hear it in the way that you do hear psychedelic furs. I often say to my friend Adam Cook, who's actually turned 47 today, I actually say to him, it's like, can you believe while we're sitting in some nice restaurant and suddenly here comes some track by the so-called P-Furs or whatnot. It's like, can you believe, would you have ever believed all those years ago that all these years later, we are still listening to this song?
Right.
Not just because it's like, wow, can you believe this is still being played? But can you believe that all this stuff since this was written and recorded is not being played?
True. Yeah. You don't hear That's What Friends Are For very often.
I don't hear Nirvana in restaurants. I don't hear most of that 90s stuff. It's not to say that it won't come.
Yeah.
It will.
But not yet. You know?
We're on the cusp of that, I think.
It's about to because
those people are now hitting that sweet spot demo
of disposable income.
Exactly.
More than that, they're entering the era of their adulthood where they will be making decisions at wherever they work.
Right.
And
to listen to what they want to listen
to. And so those companies that provide music for public spaces and businesses will be staffed and decision made by people who were kids.
Who came of age in the 90s.
Like, we were in our 20s in the 90s.
Yeah.
But the kids will who are younger than us will be the ones making decisions.
Yeah.
If not already, because it's already happening. The early 90s thing is already happening. It hasn't gained crazy traction yet.
Yeah.
But it's definitely already
happening. Here's the interesting thing. Again, if you use what we're discussing here, when was the last time you heard something from the Smiths in a restaurant? And obviously, we live in Los Angeles County, so and you guys specifically live in West Hollywood, so you're maybe more likely to hear something.
Yes.
When was the last time you heard, for instance, When I Think of You by Janet Jackson in a restaurant? Like, never. So the interesting question
only
is...
Only at Eat Well.
What stuff from the 90s is it
that will survive?
That is actually going to... That nobody, in theory, if we use the same logic... That really very few of us were listening to in the 90s.
Tons of hip hop.
Yeah.
Probably. My heart fills with dread.
But it's going to be the approachable middle of the road, like Motown Philly hip hop.
Yes, because here's the example. The Jackson Hewitt tax preparation commercials all have This Is How We Do It.
Interesting.
And the people are all dancing.
Wow.
Getting their taxes done.
Wow.
And so, and then like the TLC movie is fixing to be on here in like a day.
Fixing.
Like
VH1.
Tonight or tomorrow night, right? Like soon, So it's that moment.
Can I interject one thing?
What?
Yeah.
So last night I take the posse up to Universal Studios theme park for their Halloween Horror Nights. Mm. And the very last thing that we do is we take the so-called Terror Tram, seasonally titled Terror Tram, and you get off the Terror Tram and then you sort of walk through dioramas that they've set up in front of, amongst other things, Whoville from Ron Howard's Grinch movie, which is still standing.
That's a horror of a
Darkened, right?
That's so great.
The plane crash, the extensive outdoor plane crash in the suburbs set from Spielberg's War of the Worlds.
Whoa.
Of course, the Psycho House, the Bates Motel, right? But then as we're getting back on the tram, one of these guys says to me, hey, do you have any idea what that giant wall was the tram was driving back? He said, do you know what that giant wall was that we just drove by? And I said, no, I was just watching the Walking Dead season 4 thing. And he goes, I said, well, what else? It was like this giant wall with like a lake in front of it. I was like, oh, child, that would be That's memorialized and kept preserved as a local registered landmark for the location of TLC's famous Waterfalls video.
Horror.
Much as Universal, much as Comcast would love to tear it down and develop it as mixed use, they cannot tear down that backdrop.
Well, speaking
just of, stick with the lakes and ponds. That
nor should they.
Speaking of radio, we had an exciting moment this week where we discovered that people actually listen to this program.
Always nice. How did you get this on Twitter?
You know what?
Even better.
Old media. They listen in the wrong way.
Oh, stop. No, the right way, I would say.
While they're fapping?
I don't even want to know. No, it's early.
If that's happening, please tell us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
And by the way, do note.
Whatever.
I said fapping.
Yes, thank you for keeping it clean. Yeah. Well done.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're driving. We're going out early Wednesday morning to hit Target and Whole Foods, like, you know, right when they open before the.
Because we're excited.
Because we, you know, yes, right. We've become those people. Domestic, the parking lot is so crowded. I don't want to go early.
Get up.
So
get out of bed.
So I'm listening to the Stephanie Miller Show on KTLK, which is, you know, the progressive comedy talk show.
Right.
And her she plays there's a lot of 80s music on the show. Like every hour starts with a chunk of, you know, Katrina and the Waves is Walking on Sunshine.
Okay.
And like all of the bumpers to commercials are snippets of songs. And so 2 weeks ago, I started the show with an ABC song called 15 Story Halo that I like.
Okay,
and
Dave gave
it sucks.
Dave gave me endless abuse about it.
Right.
And then
because it sucks.
And then the conversation segued into the fact that he hates when Smokey sings even more. So anyway, so we're listening to Stephanie Miller. And
so do you. Don't you?
She's
don't you?
She's.
How about Be Near Me, though?
That's almost as bad as when Smokey sings.
Okay, Be Near Me is really good.
Y'all can both. Stop. Anyway, so Stephanie Miller is finishing the segment. They cut to commercial, and the bumper is the horn section from When Smokey Sings. And I start howling laughing, and Dave just gets this scowl on his face.
Now, how do you know that's...
10 minutes later,
yeah.
As we're going up the escalator to the Starbucks under Target, I get a Facebook message from Chris Lavoie, who is the producer of the Stephanie Miller Show.
Love this.
I've never met him in person, but we're Facebook buddies. Love and he goes, I just played When Smokey Sings on the show, and I thought about your argument with Dave.
Love this.
I just want to tell Chris Lavoie right
big
now.
Big formal shout out, Chris.
You are now my enemy. You are my music enemy.
And look, I'm sure he's stuck with whatever's in Stephanie's iPod or whatever.
Doesn't matter. We got beef.
Yeah. Just,
so don't be waiting in your car outside of the automotive museum, or else some biggie.
Stop.
Just kidding. But we super are totally music enemies now.
I'm an even bigger fan now than I was before. Not that we ever met in person, but, you know, just the When Smokey Sings moment made my week. So thank you for that.
This rages. I'll bridge from that, though. This raises an interesting point. I cannot remember where I read it. Probably someplace innocuous. Somebody wrote somewhere, maybe as a response to a letter or something like that. Something can be important or entertaining, and everybody can feel like it's important, or everyone can feel like it's entertaining, and yet still not be of any interest to you whatsoever in your life. And this is called taste. Dave White.
That's right. And mine is awesome.
Yeah. Yours is your own. That's all I'll say.
Okay, so we have to talk about movies.
Yes.
Specifically the one.
Well, what a crowded weekend.
You helped make one of them.
Yes.
This week.
I wouldn't say that I helped make it.
That's not what that credit is about. What does it do? What do you do then? What does that credit mean?
I mean, on all my partner of 16 years is writer-director Bill Condon.
That's right.
Mm.
And on all of Bill's movies over the course of the last 16 years, Gods and Monsters, Kinsey, Dreamgirls, he wrote the script for Chicago, The Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn 1 and 2, and I always feel like I'm leaving something out. He produced the 81st Academy Awards show. I always feel like I'm leaving one out.
Unless you're counting Richard Pryor, I think that's everything.
the pilot for The Big C, of course.
Oh, of course, yes. Yes, yes.
I've always worked on many, many different aspects of all of these projects, always behind the scenes. I have a special thanks credit at the end of most of them, but that's it. On most of them, I don't get paid. And yet, on the other hand, I don't have to work for a living. And the reasons why I haven't had any formal producing credits and or pay on any of these projects are varied and not that interesting. But this movie, The Fifth Estate, was the first on which it was sort of... I think Greg Yolen, who was actually sort of in the early days also a co-host of my Team Jack podcast when he was working as Bill's assistant on the two Twilight movies and the Oscar show. He and I were probably both negotiated as part of Bill's deal on Salmon Fishing in the Yemen, which was the movie that Bill developed for like a year and a half.
No kidding.
That got very close to going before Twilight, and the producer of that could not get the money together, and really chronically could not get the money together over 8 or 9 months. And then Bill finally had to put on his big boy pants and make a decision between, because Breaking Dawn kept coming back over and over and over again, and he hadn't made a movie since Dreamgirls 4 years prior. And so finally it was like, are we going to have the money, and when are we going to have the money, and what kind of guarantees? And the guy said, I can't guarantee. And Bill was like, well, then Twilight's a knock-on. Yeah. Subsequently, the guy was able to attach, even at that, when Bill was developing that and literally spent months and months working on the script with the Academy Award-winning screenwriter of Slumdog Millionaire. Simon Beaufoy, correct. Had gone overseas, had cast the movie. There was sort of a revolving door with casting. Actors would get involved and then drop out. And obviously Bill himself had already won an Oscar and had been nominated a second time. And this is all building to something, not just unbelievable narcissism toward my partner. But and had written and directed Dreamgirls, which had already, you know, which had grossed over $100 million in North America and was the most nominated movie that year. But even with his presence on what at the time I think was a $15 million movie, Bill plus the acting package involved could not get that money together. And so Bill dropped out by necessity, and the producer literally, like, had he not been able to get it together, his entire company would have failed. And this guy is a big deal. His name escapes me, but he's a big deal in UK film. He was able to attach Lasse Hallström,
right,
who directed The Shipping News, The Cider House Rules, both for Harvey Weinstein and Miramax.
My Life is a Dog.
My Life is a Dog, most notably, in my opinion. But here's the interesting thing. Attaching Lasse Hallström, who tends to crank them, just makes a movie a year and sometimes two a year. Lasse Hallström had just done one of those Nicholas Sparks movies.
And how?
Yeah, was it Dear John?
Ghost Wife.
No.
I might be wrong about that. I'm going to look it up right now.
I don't think it was
Ghost Wife. But here's the interesting thing.
It should have been.
Lasse Hallström.
How I Met Your Late Mother.
Lasse Hallström's foreign worth, as a result of the global box office earned by that Nicholas Sparks adaptation.
He did, in fact, direct Ghost Wife.
Oh, okay.
That's right.
It's not called Ghost Wife.
No, it is in this house.
Safe Haven.
Safe Haven.
A.K.A. Ghost Wife.
No. Then it's something else. Mother. Go a little further back. Safe Haven is this year.
Right. Oh, you're right. Yeah, that would have been after. Yeah, you're right. He does pump him out.
There he is, looking all Euro.
Dear John. We're both.
It's Dear John with Channing Tatum,
made
right?
Dear John too, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so I made Dear John, which made so much money around the world that when built that on the salmon fishing package with that cast that he ultimately ended up using, which was who were all cast by Bill,
Ewan
except
McGregor
for one part. Ewan McGregor and Emily Blunt and Kristin Scott Thomas, right, and When Bill, with all those achievements that I just listed, had to jump, and Lasse Hallström came in with, shall we say diplomatically, fewer of those achievements, but these this massive Dear John
grosses.
Foreign grosses.
Right.
Suddenly, the financing package, which had been stalled in neutral, is a go, and they went right away, shot the movie using most of the locations Bill had scouted with the screenplay Bill had developed and the cast that Bill had cast.
Huh.
It's welcome to the movie business.
It pays to have fewer achievements.
Sometimes it does.
So yeah. So then how do you go from acknowledgement to co-producer on this one?
Just because, again, at a certain point when he's negotiating his deal, he says there are two guys who are basically doing what would be producing work for me, and they are part of my – they will come on. They will receive co-producing credits on that picture. And moving forward, that's sort of been the model.
Hmm.
So I'll be a co-producer on A Slight Trick of the Mind, his next movie with Ian McKellen playing Sherlock Holmes at age 91.
Nice.
Yeah, it's an amazing script. It's an amazing script.
So I saw Fifth Estate this morning in Burbank.
You're kidding.
Yeah, with
just
a
this morning.
Yeah, with a foolish.
He bought it. You didn't review it for the rep.
He bought a ticket.
I recused myself because we're bros.
Right. Professional Alonzo.
Yes.
Professional recusal.
Unlike
Clarence, shout out to Peter DeBruges.
Unlike Clarence Thomas, I know when to step back. There were like 30 or 40 people. So it was, you know.
That's shocking.
Yeah, and
30 or 40?
Yeah.
That's shocking.
Yeah.
Were they mostly so-called cotton balls?
What is the white on top? Yes, yeah. It was an older audience.
Is that a thing? Is that a
yeah?
Word?
Of course,
I've heard that expression.
Cotton by balls.
People in Florida, you know.
Of course,
cotton balls.
And God bless those cotton balls who go out on a Sunday morning in Burbank.
That's right. And I was telling Dave on the way home, it passed the pee test. I had an iced coffee beforehand.
He did not want to pee all
that. Half an hour through, I was like, wow, I have a full bladder, but I'm too into this to get up. So it passed.
That's nice.
I stayed to the closing credits.
I did not recuse myself.
Right.
Because I've been to dinner with you fewer times than Alonzo.
Well, that's true.
And I've met Bill twice.
Right.
But I couldn't say, like, I couldn't say, oh, you know, he's my friend, you know,
right.
Like, so I would, I just was like, you know what, I can be completely objective about this.
Sure.
Furthermore, I also
As
have
can
a,
I, Dave White,
I also
after
have
a, 16 years, you'd be surprised how objective I can be.
I also can
about
say
his movies.
That, like, I like what he does.
Uh-huh.
And so it's easier for me to say, you know, like if I walked out of that movie and gone and thought to myself, oh God, that sucked. I can't write about this.
Right.
You know, then I probably would have gone to my editor and said, okay, this is not happening.
Right.
We
won't revisit the last 2 years with both parts of Breaking Dawn.
And
recusals as well as fondness versus.
I was very fair, I think.
Let me say, those last two Twilight movies, and I actually wrote this in my Fifth Estate review.
Okay.
That he made them watchable and weird, and that's all
right.
I ever wanted from them.
Right.
And so I got heat from readers who were furious with me for daring to say that they were pretty good, those last two Twilight films.
Within the context of what they ever need to be.
Exactly.
You don't turn them into Gravity or 12 Years a Slave.
Bill got those last two Twilight movies closer to Silk Purse territory than anybody could or did.
I'll take it.
No, so I saw Fifth Estate, and I reviewed it, and I liked it.
Okay.
And but I think the only, in terms of discussing it here as a review show, my only beef with it is that I wanted it to be longer because I don't know enough. It's 2 hours.
The runtime is about 2 hours
minutes.
Which may or may not include end titles.
And the thing is, is that walking into the screening, I've sort of studiously ignored the WikiLeaks situation.
Including Alex Gibney's doc?
Almost everything about it.
Okay.
Like, every news report I've ever seen about it gave me a chunk of information
right.
about a person involved in the sure. situation.
And most notably, Bradley, now Chelsea Manning.
Yes.
Right.
And I've never quite been able to piece it together in my head so that it makes sense.
Yeah, like Dave came back from the screening and said, what do you know about WikiLeaks? And I went, well,
Do we really have to have this conversation?
I'm saying before I saw the movie.
No, that's what you say to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, so I had a vague notion. So
yeah.
the movie has to, by design, spend time bringing you up to snuff.
Yes, the heavy, so-called heavy lifting.
There's exactly. so much information.
Which mostly happens in the first half an hour, 45 minutes.
Kind of, yeah. But, I mean, yeah. it goes through the entire film.
Yeah.
And there's so much information to know if you don't know anything. Because, I mean,
right.
I consider myself fairly well-informed about right. stuff that I feel affects me.
Right.
And that was the other problem with WikiLeaks, is that it didn't feel immediately relevant to my life. And I
sure.
remember thinking at the time, someday eventually there'll be like a documentary about this, and
right.
I'll figure it out then.
You can consume the information.
For right now, Rachel Maddow is not making enough sense to me to tell me what's happening.
She's also not landing it in your day-to-day.
Right. And so when I saw the film, I thought, okay, now I get it.
And you get enough of it. You still may feel...
I still want more.
Unimpressed with its impact on your life personally.
I want more information because I feel like, based on what I learned from this film, that it really is going to impact my life and your life and your life
uh-huh.
in really gross ways as time goes on.
Right.
And more, you know, people who bring forth, you know, damning information about
most notably Edward Snowden.
Yes.
Via Glenn Greenwald at The Guardian.
Yeah.
And the New York Times now.
Michael Hastings and his whole, like...
Yes, Michael Hastings who makes a
cameo appearance.
Film, yeah.
Posthumous cameo.
In the movie. And I was like, that's
isn't
not...
Isn't that interesting?
That's... when he showed up, I thought, because somebody killed him.
Probably.
Yeah.
Someone killed him.
Somebody not foreign.
Someone killed him.
Yeah, that feels like car tampering.
That was a recent cover story of LA Weekly.
Yeah. And so...
For our listeners.
I just, you know, because I got the information I needed and because it didn't, like, overwhelm me with minutia that should have been in a 10-hour HBO miniseries.
Of course.
I like how he can take the chunks of stuff
right.
that you need and put them together in a way that doesn't feel like broccoli.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
And I was trying to think about, like, how does it fit with his other films? And I thought, well, in a way, it's like Kinsey in terms of being about somebody who is changing the game of
yes.
information, basically. You know, what people know, what they want to know, what they think they're allowed to know.
A true visionary who stands outside the societal norm, who, as he says in the movie, may be said to be dangling on the autistic spectrum.
Right.
Alfred Kinsey also, a very, very unlikable man.
Mm-hmm.
But these two men who saw something that nobody else could really see, perhaps in part because of certainly their early childhood or adolescent experiences,
right.
and who they became as a result of that, and have changed
society,
culture, and
yeah.
society in unbelievably massive ways. Now that all this said, I'll tell you something interesting. There was a screening a couple of weeks ago on the Disney lot, ironically. Obviously, Disney is handling the marketing and distribution for DreamWorks Pictures presently, so the Fifth Estate, a movie about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, is being marketed and distributed by the Walt Disney Company. There's a screening on the lot that Lawrence O'Donnell attends, who, for the uninitiated, I have no idea what your listenership is, but is an anchor, right?
Right, on MSNBC.
On MSNBC, which is a far left-leaning... Not far?
No, it is center-left at best.
Okay.
For U.S. media.
Network. He tapes his show early to come to the screening that night. He watches the movie, which I believe he thoroughly enjoyed. Bill, who always has MSNBC on, not a surprise, gets to stand and talk with the very tall Mr. O'Donnell for like an hour after the screening. And probably the most interesting thing that Lawrence O'Donnell had to say, again, Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC had to say to Bill that night is, well, just as a warning, in terms of potentially the box office that yet to come, which we have now seen, he said, I have to tell you that our news network, and I presume he meant most, if not all, news networks, and maybe most television, I have no idea. But he said, at MSNBC, we measure ratings in 15-minute increments. And I have to tell you, pretty consistently over the last 3 years, in which this 3 or 4 years in which Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, and then Edward Snowden, Glenn Greenwald, etc., have all emerged from nowhere
right.
into the center of the discussion. He said, anytime we have any of these guys on, or we have, you know, we tease, well, when we come back after commercial, we will have the ratings plummet. And that's on MSNBC.
Wow.
Glenn Greenwald, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, people, including those watching the lefty news channel. You can only imagine Fox News or CNN. People don't want to know. People do not want to know, and they turn it off.
I think that
I could see
that. I think it's because of what I just said. I think it feels like too much to figure out.
Yeah.
And your place in it feels unsure. Is up until seeing the film.
Right.
Every time a newscast would come on, I would think I don't understand.
And I kind of don't.
They're not helping me understand.
I think it's hard enough to get people to hear the bad news from established sources.
Yeah.
I think once you start bringing in the non-established sources, quote unquote,
the rogues.
Yeah. Then people are just like, do not bum me out with this.
Do not bum me out by these guys, specifically in the case of Julian Assange, this Australian, who he doesn't like us. He's criticizing us. He's attacking us. He's not our friend. He's not a friend of the United States. Different from Snowden, who is more... Snowden's television personality is more reasonable. Snowden, obviously, is also an American.
Yeah,
so it could be said that Snowden truly is, if you want to have the debate, whether or not, you know, as was sort of used in the Disney marketing for the Fifth Estate, hero or traitor.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really use the word traitor as regards Julian because he's not an American.
Right.
With Snowden, you certainly can.
Right.
You can have that debate. But what you sort of get you sort of have a sense of he's hostile to the United States, so that makes me nervous. And one piece of analysis that I've sort of that's come to me in the last week, obviously since this movie was greenlit, WikiLeaks has been referred, WikiLeaks through their Twitter, which is Julian.
Right.
Which is totally Julian from the Ecuadorian embassy in London where he's been holed up. WikiLeaks has been referring to it as DreamWorks, DreamWorks' anti-WikiLeaks movie or the Disney DreamWorks anti-WikiLeaks movie. And then he sort of went a little quiet during production and there was an email correspondence happening with Benedict Cumberbatch, the actor who played him.
Didn't they leak the script on WikiLeaks?
They leaked a draft of the Fifth Estate. Yeah, through their Twitter handle and their mirror sites. My take on it on a lot of this is, you know, there would probably be a lot of easy thinking that would surmise that Julian Assange's attacks on the movie have perhaps impacted its reception at the box office or its critical reception. My take is that I don't know that Julian, and again, any time that he's attacked, it always gets picked up everywhere from Forbes to Entertainment Weekly to the Wall Street Journal. Everybody picks it up. It's incredibly sticky. Anything that he really does or any move that he makes is still closely watched by all these news sources. I think every time he's attacked the movie, it's reminded people, including potential audiences, ticket buyers, how unpleasant a personality he is. And basically what it leads you to go is like, why do I want to go sit in a theater for 2 hours and just watch a movie about this guy? Well, it's not the attacks themselves. Who cares whether or not Julian is happy with this or that project? Alex Gibney's documentary that was made about him and released by Focus Features over the summer called We Steal Secrets, which you can get on iTunes right now.
Right.
Gibney himself, an Oscar winner. Or The Fifth Estate. And obviously, Julian sort of has a famously contrarian personality, which is part of the visionary,
right.
You know? So did Alfred Kinsey. But most mainstream American audiences really are not going to want to put down good money just as we're coming out of a recession to sit in a theater for 2 hours and watch an unlikable character.
Well, I think the other thing that happens when he speaks out is that it reminds people that the story isn't over.
Correct.
You know, and I think that you're not going to go to a movie and have this big...
You're not going to get a happy ending.
Or an ending.
Or even a resolution.
Yeah.
You're gonna end up with him where he is in the Ecuadorian embassy about 3 blocks behind Harrod's department store.
Telling you not
London.
To go see the movie that you're watching right now.
That's a pretty brilliant closer.
That's a little bit of Bill Condon. There's another scene, too, that I'll tell you that's interesting. The whole thing about this movie, out of all the movies that he's made during the time I've been involved with him, is so interesting. But in so many ways, there is a scene where Julian goes back with Daniel Domscheitberg's parents to their home, sort of against Daniel's wishes, after the parents make a dinner invitation to him after a talk that he gives. Mm-hmm. And what transpires there in that scene, which was written by Bill. I have no idea. I don't think it's based in any reality whatsoever, but it was needed to sort of articulate certain character moments that were needed at that point in the narrative. Some people they're with the movie, and they're with even the Julian character until they get to that scene.
Yep.
And then they go, after that scene, I didn't give a
flying
frack. I'll call all my BSG fandoms. Nice. I didn't give a frack about this guy. That's I didn't care what he had to say. Other people, hilarious. And literally, like, long lists. If I had to sit here with a ruled notepad and make lists of friends and family and Academy members we know, serious professionals, people who we don't let off the hook. There are people who have said to us, oh, it's my favorite movie that Bill's ever made. My response is, really? Like, better than Gods and Monsters? You know? Yes. I can sit here with a ruled pad and say, here's a list of the people who got off the bus at that scene. Here's a list of people who thought that scene was the greatest scene in that movie. It's
I like
so
that scene.
Polarizing.
It's pivotal, for sure.
I really like that scene because I sat there and I did, in my head, you know, I'm a film critic, so I can't get off the bus. But in my head, I thought, well, you're not nice.
Not at all.
I don't like you very much at all.
And when was the last nice time you saw a scene like that
make you dinner.
In an American studio movie?
Yeah, no.
But the thing is, I don't think the scene just exists to make him look like a jerk. I think part of it is like, okay, you are this wounded, walking nerve ending.
No, I know.
And this being in this situation is reminding you of everything you don't have and didn't have in your life, you know.
A loving parents.
Yeah.
And literally, the minute you come into that scene, right on the cut, you hear soft classical music playing.
Yes.
There's a Christmas tree in the background.
In the beautifully decorated home of these, I suppose, middle class people in suburban Berlin, you know?
And amazing cast. I mean, just I mean, in the opening credits,
which
I mean,
a Condon strong.
I was like, my God, Moritz Bleibtreu's in this. Yeah. Carice Van Houten's in this, and then we get a scene where it's, you know, David Thewlis standing next to Peter Capaldi, standing next to Matthew Crawley. You know,
Dan Stevens.
Matthew Crawley, don't mess with me. So I was, you know, and Laura Linney's in it, and Anthony Mackie, and Stanley Tucci, and of course, obviously, Cumberbatch is great, and Daniel Brühl. Brühl, I'll tell you, this and Rush are interesting kind of...
Yeah, I'm into him now.
It's a very interesting moment for young Daniel Brühl.
Yeah, but I mean, but just the way that, like, in because in Rush, he's almost playing the sort of Assange character in terms of being the super analytical, intellectual, antisocial one. You
Absolutely.
Know? So it's kind of cool to see him sort of flip that around.
Anyway, it's so great for this movie, again, for a studio movie. You can't really say it's an American movie because this movie, the financing for this movie was cobbled together by a sort of international consortium. It's a $27 million movie. When was so nice to have in a movie like that a German playing a German, as opposed to you know, some early choices for that role were James McAvoy, Joel Kinnaman, who is on The Killing, who is the new RoboCop. You know, how can we get someone who is a little sexier, has a little bigger name? Bill met Daniel Brühl in Berlin, and it was love at first sight. And then he really had to sort of push to get his way with Daniel Brühl, which included, by the way, Ron Howard sending over either select scenes or potentially the entire movie so that the head of the studio, Stacy Snyder, and I think Steven Spielberg could watch Rush just to know that after Goodbye Lenin, there was there were more great performances coming from Daniel Brühl. And hilariously, what was such an uphill struggle 9 months ago when this movie was in pre-production, incredibly, 9 months ago.
Wow, really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, right after the Breaking Dawn 2 premiere, he never came back from the European premieres. He immediately started pre-production in Brussels. But 9 months ago, nobody would have seen... There was the vision of, from Stacy Snyder and Steven Spielberg, there was the vision of Benedict Cumberbatch, who they had cast in War Horse.
Right.
They knew that he was Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness because I think their relationship, their friendship, and
Spielberg and Abrams,
and J.J. Abrams have stayed friendly post Super 8.
Right.
So it was the suggestion for Cumberbatch to play Julian Assange actually came from Stacy. Knowing that Benedict was going to be the villain in a major summer tent pole, that Paramount would be spending a fortune on marketing, and probably that a lot of the marketing would be built around Benedict Cumberbatch. So they knew there was a bit of inside betting going on there. I believe actually Spielberg and somebody else in the company had seen, I think, Star Trek Into Darkness in rough assemblage. So not only did they know that Cumberbatch, greatness from War Horse or Atonement or Sherlock, but they were actually seeing him as Khan, and they said, he's amazing, and we know what this is going to be next summer. What was less apparent at the time was that
Daniel Brühl
and Rush would end up being released a month before Fifth Estate would turn out to sort of be such a thing. People love Rush.
I have not
seen it.
It hasn't been doing huge numbers, but everybody that I've seen it. It's really terrific. I really like it a lot, and I'm not a big Ron Howard fan.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned about casting a German as a German, because one of the trailers, I never watch trailers unless on those rare occasions I actually pay to see a movie like I did this morning.
And I saw, you and I are cut from the same cloth.
There were like 8 trailers before Fifth Estate. It was insane.
Which was driving you crazy.
Yeah, so they kept coming. Anyway, one of them was for The Book Thief.
Yeah.
And you know, this little girl hiding out during World War II.
Based on the novel.
Exactly. And the German parents that take her in are played by Jeffrey Rush and Breaking the Waves.
Oh, my Lanta. What's her name?
Emily.
They're all Emilys.
Yeah. And not only that, but the little girl and Jeffrey Rush are sort of both teaching themselves how to read. So they do this thing where they have like the whole alphabet on the wall, and they like write in chalk under each letter, like words that start with that letter.
Right.
And all the words are in English.
Wow. Yeah.
So there. Yeah. All right. We should maybe.
Hang on. I have one more question.
Okay.
You can have 1,000 more questions.
9 months ago, pre-production?
It's crazy.
Was everything one take?
No, but the entire approach to the production, including the day-to-day on set, was infused by a sort of spirit, the spirit of these young web guys who were running and gunning guerrilla style. Mm. Bill's cinematographer, Tobias Schliessler, who shot Dreamgirls with and for him, but also notably has shot most of Peter Berg's movies, including Friday Night Lights, the feature, is very, needless to say, very, very comfortable with lots of handheld and having, I think, four operators moving through shots on... during takes, and Tobias is also, of course, German.
Well, I was just thinking about how the second unit on this movie had to be running around all over the place.
That's crazy.
Not so much.
Was it just cities faking other cities? Or,
yes, there was a lot of that.
Because there's a lot of globetrotting in this movie, and I figured, okay, maybe the interiors are all they're all in Germany, but everything else is, you know, they actually went and shot, you know,
A lot of the stage work was done in Brussels. They did shoot Berlin for Berlin. There were lots of other locations that were shot, sort of the unit moving out, satelliting from Brussels. They did go to Iceland. They did go to, for the Nairobi material, they went to Africa. But it is kind of crazy that, again, Breaking Dawn Part 2 was released in the middle of November.
Right.
Near the Hunger Games date this year, and here we are already.
Wow.
Here we are already done. There will be no 6 months of attacks and subterfuge and whisper campaigns against the Fifth Estate. We're finished today, which is great because Mr. Condon is in La Jolla.
Yeah,
prepping his musical.
I mean, I think, and I'll go back and cut this if this was something that wasn't intended for air, but I seem to recall you mentioning that Mr. Condon was not eager to do another, like, Oscar heave this year.
No, really, really not eager to do another one. Really not eager to do another one. So, that said, I don't think if you'd asked him, well, what are you hoping for in terms of the critical and commercial reception? He would have replied with something so definitive, shall we say. But, I mean, actually, you know what when we would talk about that stuff, which is a few months ago now, he would say, all he really said was, and it does sound like I'm sort of talking about my relationship with Barack Obama or something, but in a way, for the last 9 months, I've seen so little of him.
Mm.
Obviously, we've been together for 16 years, but I never initiate phone calls. Obviously, there are emails going back and forth and stuff, but given the intensity of the pre-production, sure, principal photography and post-production on this movie, and then the Toronto Film Festival, all this stuff, and then straight down to La Jolla for this musical Sideshow, I wait to hear from him, and sometimes I hear from him every 3 days, and that's it.
Wow. Right.
So these, when I say, like, 3 months ago, what he did say on the subject was, it's because our conversations are, it's not that they're infrequent, but they're infrequent. All he hoped for 3 months ago was that it would get a fair release, and what I would say is, between all the publicity, Benedict Cumberbatch working his posterior off. I'm really trying to keep it squeaky.
You can say ass.
The opposite of my podcast.
You can say ass on TV, so you can say ass on here.
Benedict did all that could be done. All of Julian Assange's attacks and all of the publicity that kicked up and generated, and then just, frankly, a phenomenal marketing job by this guy, Kevin Campbell, at who runs marketing at the Walt Disney Company, who is one of us.
At Disney?
There's nothing to... There's. We did get a fair release. We got a more than fair release, you know? So I think... I take the long view on this. I'm very circumspect. I think... Or I try to be very circumspect about most things. This is really just a product launch, if you will.
Sure.
Product sounds coarse, but it's like making an impression now so that down the road when someone is on an airplane or in a hotel room or Netflix, VOD, DVD, Blu-ray...
Here's
That Fifth Estate, that Benedict Cumberbatch.
The cotton balls don't run out on opening weekend anyway.
They never do, famously. And we'll be dealing with them again on the Sherlock Holmes movie.
And that's going to be the majority of the audience, I think.
Yeah. Although my parents, who are in their mid-70s, my father, the retired Army colonel, said, you know, Jack, I don't really think a lot of friends of ours are going to be interested in seeing this one. It's like, oh, and they couldn't wait for Twilight. And in fact, it's sort of like, currently they live in the middle of Missouri at Lake of the Ozarks. Wait, all your friends were just waiting with bated breath for the all black singing and dancing musical. They couldn't wait for Dreamgirls. It's like, when is Bill Condon going to make a movie that does appeal to my parents' friends?
Like, I missed the press screening for All Is Lost, and I went to see it yesterday.
Right.
At AMC in Century City.
Right.
I turned 50 next year.
Right.
And I was the youngest person in that house.
For sure. Yeah. Well, who's the star of that movie?
And some grandpa.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So,
who, by the way, you can make an argument as regards to the mainstream movie-going audience. Grandpa is probably no more or better known by the mainstream movie-going audience today than is Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right.
True. Right. This is true. Yeah.
You have to say so. On the other hand, Tom Hanks playing Captain Phillips.
Tom Phipps.
Holds the number two slot at the box office this weekend because Tom Hanks, even after recent missteps, including one of my favorite movies of last year, Cloud Atlas, haters gonna hate and I don't care, Tom Hanks can still open the right movie, seemingly.
Another trailer I got today was
Saving Mr. Banks, written by my friend Kelly Marcel.
Yeah, cool. It just closed the London Film Festival, and apparently people are already raving about it.
Did they get reviewed out of that, though?
Yeah.
You wouldn't know because you won't read them.
I won't read it, but I got an Ann Thompson blast that was raving in the headline.
Is Ann Thompson a listener?
I have no idea.
I had to unsubscribe from Ann Thompson's blasts.
How do I blast?
I find that stuff is just, it's just, some of that stuff, you have to be able to control the influx of the information.
You know, there are a lot of emails I don't open.
Yeah, but you still see that subject line.
I look at the header, I'm like, okay.
The subject line is bad enough in certain ways.
True, but, you know, I feel like I got the gist and I can move on with my life, you know. I was going to ask you something else, and now I'm blanking on what it was, so it probably wasn't that important. Awesome. Well, let us run through the rest of this week.
All right.
Yeah, and I'll talk trash about all these films I haven't seen.
Great.
Yay.
Escape Plan.
Woo, which you saw and I did
not. I saw it.
And by the way, let's just set the record straight. Someone, I think Brian Duffield on Twitter pointed out, a Hollywood Reporter sent out an email blast, I think midday Friday, announcing the bombing of the Fifth Estate. But is anybody discussing the bombing of the $70 million?
Yes.
They are?
They are.
All right, good. But because, again, I'm tuned out.
It's not as sexy a bombing as Fifth Estate.
It's not.
Well, what's $70 million what?
The Escape Plan.
Oh, Escape Plan cost $70 million. We cost $27 million. Yeah.
But they're thinking more of a European recoup for Stallone and Schwarzenegger.
Well, yeah.
Well, we'll see.
Probably. Who knows?
It's not the worst thing in the world.
Who directed, as Jennifer Hudson would say?
Mikhail Hulse.
I don't know who the director is. Do not know the director.
Mikhail Salomon, the DP?
No.
Another Mikhail?
Another Mikhail.
But they're in prison.
Mikhail Hofsnettner. Pardon me.
The look it up phones.
I'm looking up
dueling
stuff.
Phones.
Just
anyway, so Sly is the world's most renowned prison break expert. He literally wrote
Mikhail
the book.
Mikhail Hofstrom.
He literally wrote the book on the subject. Okay. It is sitting on the desk of Jim Caviezel, who is the evil warden.
Oh, he directed The Rite, that crazy exorcism movie with Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah. And 1408.
And Jim Caviezel's the evil warden, and you know he's the evil warden because he's meticulous and fastidious about things on his outfit. He's always picking at himself, and he listens to classical music in his office, and he collects butterflies and does things to them under their little
puts pins
things
in them.
And puts pins in them. And
nice to have a job in a movie, though.
So hey. What now?
Nice to have a job in a movie, though.
That's right. That's right.
He's a hardcore Christian, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
Like of the Mel Gibson
But not Church so hardcore that he won't be in a Sly Stallone Schwarzenegger movie and say the F swear, which he does.
Nothing wrong with hardcore Christians. It's just when you get into the weird, like, orthodoxy branch of that, which I think he's in.
Yeah.
Right? He's in the Mel Gibson church,
the,
right?
The mass should still be in Latin, people.
Yeah.
Like your Opus Dei.
It's not hardcore Christians. It's mega, like, crazy Catholic, super Catholic.
Yeah, it's not Victoria Jackson kind of Christian.
Yeah, it's not this whole other Southern Baptist Christian.
Yes. Yeah. So, and then you got Schwarzenegger as a guy on the inside, and they put Stallone in these prisons so that he can break out of them and detect their flaws, and that's how he makes his living.
It's like Redford in Sneakers.
And they put him in...
Right.
They put him in Future Jail.
A movie I love.
Which is like all glass and there's no systems and you can't detect patterns. Like if you're going to be a prison breaker, you can't.
Right.
And but then he finds out that he's been put there and then they like threw away his code. So his evacuation code.
Okay.
Nobody knows what it is.
Okay.
And they don't know who he is.
I've lost
and
track
so
of the plot.
He's there sort of forcibly, and they've forgotten about him.
Okay.
So he has to figure out how to get out, and I'm just going to spoil everything because this movie is so stupid.
Too late.
And he finds out that the prison is, if you don't want to hear the spoiler, if you think you're going to see this movie, just turn down your volume for like 15 seconds, starting 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, now. The prison is on a giant, like, tanker in the middle of the ocean.
Okay.
And it goes so deep down that the prisoners don't know where they are.
Right.
They never see daylight.
Right.
They never leave their boxes.
Right.
And,
they're lucite boxes.
When he finally figures out where they are, he gets up to the deck.
Yeah,
and he finds out he's on the ocean.
I'm on a boat,
and he's like, "Oh no, what do I do?" And so, like,
where are my flippy floppies?
Schwarzenegger tries to help him because Schwarzenegger, it turns out, is someone significant in the plot, in the whole "we're putting you here" sort of thing. And
what I want from this moment is when they get to the surface of the boat.
Yes.
They discover that they're on the Exxon Valdez with Dennis Hopper as the deacon.
They're on the Captain Phillips boat.
Reprising his role from Waterworld.
It is not the terriblest thing that has ever been terribled.
Uh-huh.
Is it better than all of the Expendables movies?
Yes, here's the thing. It's better than all the Expendables movies because it takes itself seriously the way... Let's say this had happened in 1987, that they teamed up at the height of their thing.
Relevance.
Both of them.
Exactly.
This would have been a monster movie because, A, they would have been at the height of their relevance
and
the height of their stardom.
Right.
And the movie is just, you know, it's whatever, but it's not a joke. There's not everybody's not winking at the camera like, isn't it funny that we're all in this movie together?
Wow.
You know, it's not like those Expendables movies, which I was really looking forward to, and they all turned out to be super boring.
Yeah. Not my teacup.
So, it's, you know, whatever. It's a lot of whatever. If you're down for this, then go. If you're not, you're not going to miss anything by not going.
And then also, speaking of old men on a boat, is All Is Lost this weekend, which
I saw yesterday and you saw before.
I liked a lot.
Yeah,
it's really great. I mean, do you know the shtick of this movie?
Sure.
No dialogue.
Yep.
Or almost no dialogue.
Yep.
No character
except
name.
Except Robert Redford going,
and he radios for help, and he utters one four-letter word that's well-deserved by that point in the film.
Right.
Nobody else is in it. His character doesn't have a name. His character has no backstory. It is just It is literally the old man in the sea, period.
Right, right.
That's all there is. Not even the fish.
Right.
And it's There's riveting.
A fish.
I know, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
The Hemingway fish, you know what I mean?
I know.
Anyway, I found it captivating.
That's great.
It is super stripped down. It's the second film from the guy that made Margin Call.
That's right.
Which could not be more different, because Margin Call was all like, let's get 20 movie stars in a room and have them yap, yap, yap about the financial collapse. And so, yeah, he's going a totally different direction. And it's suspenseful, and it kind of makes you realize, like, oh, hey, well, here's
that a... you're going to die.
Well, that, yes. But also, here's a movie that assumes that you're paying attention and you don't have everything underlined for you. You know,
yeah.
They don't give him a parrot or a puppy to talk to.
Right. Volleyball.
Or a volleyball to explain what his next move is going to be, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, I thought it was really good. Although, you know, the joke that I wanted to make in my review, but I thought it was too obscurantist even for me, was the initiating incident of the script is that
by all means go tell it right now.
Well, because Jack,
I think it's in the trailer, isn't it?
Yeah, this big cargo container in the corner, it's
floating
hits
in the
ship.
Middle of nowhere.
Yeah, hits the yacht, puts a big hole in the bow.
Yeah,
and at one point the cargo container opens and out come all these cheap tennis shoes, and I thought, sneakers, because it's Robert Redford.
Oh yeah,
get it. Okay. That.
So, yeah, that's a good one. That's great.
So anyway, he's great in it, and the movie's terrific, and I think of it as a top 10 contender.
If you like Gravity.
Yeah, and I had not seen Gravity.
I saw this coming
yet.
Months ago. I said to Nicole Sperling at the LA Times, when and who is the first person who's going to write, and when and where is it going to be written? The connecting thing here between Gravity, All Is Lost, and Captain Phillips.
Yep. And 12 Years a Slave.
And 12 Years a Slave.
And guess what's on the front page of this morning's New York Times by Mr. A.O. Scott?
Yeah.
The very same.
I thought about writing that piece for linoleum-knife.com, and then I thought, no,
well done.
Everyone's going to write that piece, so I didn't
write.
Yeah.
Tis
the season of one human versus the void.
Exactly, yeah. But yeah, I would put 12 Years a Slave in that category, too,
because
it's also a survival tale.
A movie I will never see.
Really?
Yeah.
Just not doing it?
Again, this is what's called a refrain. A movie can be said to be incredibly important and or entertaining, and yet, here, watch how I do this. Hang the DJ, hang the DJ, hang the DJ, because the music that they constantly play says nothing to me about my life. And never watch it, which is why a lot of people will never watch Fifth Estate.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never watch 12 Years a Slave. Right. Someone said or tweeted in Toronto, it may have been Cameron, what's-his-face, the festival director, in his introductory remarks for the screening up in Toronto of 12 Years, that we're all responsible for slavery in some way, and I was just like, no.
No.
I don't accept that. And guess what? My parents aren't responsible for slavery, and guess what? My grandparents aren't responsible for slavery. And guess what? Their parents came over from Ireland. They're not responsible for slavery.
Yeah, my parents were immigrants, so you're not pinning this crap
on
me.
Yeah, it's like, come on. Give me a break.
It was interesting that I had totally forgotten about this, but in the 80s...
I'm sure someone in my family has been in the Klan. So yeah. My family's probably responsible for slavery.
Yeah, your family is. So you need to go see 12 Years a Slave and Atone.
I did.
You saw it.
I saw it. I wrote about it. But
wait, have we not reviewed that yet? Is that
not yet? We're fixing to talk about it right now.
Yeah, because it opened this weekend.
That's why we're talking.
It's the crazy weekend of all time.
That's the problem with the rap. Like, they've got me reviewing stuff so early now. I forget if I've already talked about it here.
Right.
I don't know if I've ever had any family members in the Klan. It just stands to reason.
It would not
I think
be a
you
shocker
did, Dave.
That
Dave, I think looking at you,
based on
I think you did,
based on my, based on the family that I know and the where they've all been in life.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm finally at last week's Entertainment Weekly. Like, it's been taking me a while to catch up. Anyway, so last week they did a whole story about movies, all the movies based on true stories this fall, including
Good
Saint. And there are these quotes from John Ridley, who wrote the screenplay to 12 Years a Slave, and Henry Louis Gates Jr., who really.
Well, why is no one writing that either?
What?
Scab?
As I said to someone else yesterday who shall remain nameless because I think that person is writing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no one seems to remember, and I remember only because, again, all politics are local, and Bill Condon sat on the negotiating committee for the Writers Guild during the last...
strike.
What turned out to be a strike situation.
Yes.
And John Ridley went FICOR and became a scab.
What's FICOR?
financial core, where you basically renounce your guild membership and you sort of drill down. The guild called him out. Just Google John Ridley Scab, and you'll see stuff at the Huffington Post. The guild attacked him and a few other writers by name for basically
keeping saying
yeah. And then the sort of ratification of that was the famous anti-union person who very successfully lives in Northern California hired him to, I will not name that person, hired him to write
Red Tails. George Lucas.
Because he's a non-union writer. At the time, he was a non-union writer.
I didn't know that.
I did not know that either. The things you learn.
Well, it's just like, it's, but I mean, this was, and I don't, can't remember how many years ago that strike was, but that strike was a huge thing.
No,
and
I remember
he was the face of
Scabbery. Wow.
And now, this season.
Oh, wow, okay. Well, anyway, so
I assure you, no WGA award
nomination
for him.
Interesting.
None. And we'll see about the writer's branch of the Academy.
So 12 Years a Slave. Anyway, these quotes in EW from him and from Henry Louis Gates Jr., who are the consultant, talking about how, like, at last, you know, Solomon Northrup gets his movie, gets his story told. I had forgotten until Leonard Maltin mentioned this week, he already got one. Gordon Parks in the 80s made a PBS film called Solomon Northrup's Odyssey. Odyssey that's based on 12 Years a Slave.
Wow.
Yeah. And apparently was
very well received.
Yeah. Once he said that title, I totally remember that. Like that won awards and it was a big deal. And I had utterly forgotten its connection to this.
Interesting.
So this is actually a remake, technically speaking.
Well, one of the competing awards consultants will call everyone to mind.
Whisper.
We'll be sending out screeners of that as a way of anti-messaging, exactly.
So it is very much the new Steve McQueen movie. If you saw Hunger, if you saw Shame, he has a thing about
male bodies.
About male bodies, but also like not even just male bodies in this one, because there's women involved now too, which is new. But about sort of taking things to extremes, and you know, it's almost sort of Cronenbergian in a way,
right?
But within the realms of harsh realism,
right?
So that's kind of what the main thing this movie is about. And I mean, I also sort of looked at it as almost kind of a Hitchcockian thing, where you've got this guy who thinks he's a free man until, you know, he makes the mistake of going to Washington, D.C. with some untrustworthy people, and he gets drugged, and next thing he knows, he's been sold into bondage.
Right. Like, going in, knowing about Steve McQueen's work, even going back before Hunger, to his art world stuff, because, you
Steve
know,
McQueen, and What ethnicity is he? You would say African.
He's black.
What?
African British.
His parents. Yeah, parents are from Grenada.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he lives in London.
He was born in England. Yeah.
Where he found success in the art world.
No real connection to American slavery. But yeah, I knew him because of the art world, you know, because I'm such a next level art bro and
yes,
all.
Yes, yes. And we're all so impressed.
Pumpkin pancakes.
Thank you. Thank you. But his ongoing art practice is about, and when I say about, I'm telling you that I don't exactly always know what he's about.
Because which is fine.
That's fine, because that can be a life's work.
Yeah.
But it's all about, you know, the uses and misuses and voluntary and involuntary
abuses
of the body. And so you've got Shame. I mean, you've got Hunger, where Bobby Sands is voluntarily hunger striking and dying in the service of his freedom and the service of his country's freedom.
His cause.
And that cause is?
The IRA.
Thank you.
And then you've got...
Filling in your narrative here.
Oh, thank you.
Then for the listeners.
You're very good at that. When I listen to your show...
Very 101.
You're very good with the follow-up questions to make sure we're all on the same
page. I credit a lifetime spent in a shrink's office.
And then you've got Shame, where Fassbender is back, and he's you know, an obsessive person who has lots of sex and masturbates a lot.
Right.
And, I'm sorry, Faps. And...
Masturbates is a clinical term.
I know. I just wanted to say fap. It's fine. Again. The which I think is a, now that I've had 2 years away from it, I think it's a much less successful movie artistically, because instead of simply observing, which is kind of what he does in Hunger,
okay,
I think Steve McQueen in Shame sort of brings his own ideas about what this guy is doing to himself. Like, there's an idea in the movie that having too much sex hurts your soul, uh-huh, and or sex without love.
Uh-huh.
And so,
disinterested in both of these,
yeah,
concepts.
And I feel like that is not his. It's not, as an artist who's made a career so far of being sort of distanced and observational.
Right.
This is not his place to be telling you, oh yes, I mean, he looks exhausted because he has sex all the time, but he's Michael Fassbender. Look at,
yeah.
I mean, good-looking people,
yeah,
have access to as much sex as they want to have, yeah. And so the.
Also, I'll pass on the moralizing. Thank you.
Yeah,
with Alfred Kinsey.
So back here, back now at 12 Years a Slave, you've got a scenario that people have incredibly strong feelings about. It's almost impossible to be that clinical and that observational and that distanced from it. And it is a really affecting movie because of the extended sorrow and pain and brutality and violence that exists in the movie.
Right.
But I feel like he really is gone back to that distant observational method.
Okay.
And it's hard for me to know. It's a very affecting movie. It's hard for me to know if I think it's like the masterpiece that everyone is saying it is.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what I'm supposed to feel at the end of it,
yeah.
Other than overwhelmed and shaken and horrified by the thing I have just witnessed.
Like, right. Yeah, there's a big scene at the end, and I mean, this isn't a spoiler because it's based on this guy's book, so you know that the 12 that years ends and he survives.
He lived, yes. Yeah.
When he is reunited with his family at the end of the film, I remember thinking, oh, God, if this were the end of The Color Purple, I would be a sobbing heap on the floor right now.
Uh-huh.
But the way that McQueen shoots it and the way that McQueen shoots everything, I'm looking at it from back here.
It's detached.
You know, we're over here looking at the thing. And so, which is fine. I mean, it's a style and it is a choice, and I
it
honor
is
that.
Beautifully.
And that level of restraint may really be abundantly connected to its reception at this moment.
Hmm.
That restraint may really be the catnip for, at least in part, motivating the reaction at the moment. Because the reaction at the moment, as Dave White has said,
yeah, the early reviews out of festivals were,
it's a masterpiece. It's, which it invariably, I would say, it may or may not be a masterpiece. Things that are that receive this level of the hype. Of hype in the culture, I find never hold that position,
right,
years later.
Right.
Or even if they hold the position, you see it's a masterpiece, but it's a movie that's of interest to 100 people.
Well, you're starting to see some naysayers emerge, and not just Armand White. Like,
yeah.
Other people are kind of saying, well, you know, I mean,
yeah.
And I don't. I'm
Amy
I'm,
Nicholson at the LA Weekly, who's our friend, uh-huh, she does not like it. I have not read her review.
So
yet.
I have Bryce Renninger. I've seen some people who have not been fans, but I think that it's mostly effective. I don't generally care about the Oscars. I don't. It's not my job,
right,
to prognosticate
them. Sports and sports casting, folks.
Yeah. But I kind of jokingly said to Adam Berry and to Kyle Buchanan, who were two of the biggest cheerleaders for it out
well,
of Toronto.
Kyle Buchanan, yeah.
I jokingly said to them, this is the movie that's going to win the Butler Best Picture. Because this is I think for a lot of older Academy members, because you've always said, Jack, that the thing that they respond to is leaving with that up.
Yes.
You know, that moving thing.
Yeah.
I feel like that they're going to see this thing and it's going to be too clinical for them, and it's going to remind them about that other nice black movie that they liked so much. You know?
They're always, if you really do want to get into sports and sports casting, and again, the guy I live with has one. He's been nominated for two. He's was obsessed with the Oscars from the age of 10. What Star Wars was for me, the Oscars were for him. Then he went off to Columbia, where he met Damian Bona, who for years and years was sort of the acknowledged world expert on Oscar history, wrote a book with Mason Wiley called Inside Oscar, which was considered definitive, wrote the, at the time, speaking of, you know, ancient history and isn't this quaint, wrote the one article of the year that the New York Times would have on the Oscar race. They would always call Damien, this is before David Carr, to write the one article of the year. So Bill grew up obsessed and fascinated with Oscar lore and just watching the races and really taking pleasure in all of that stuff. Then was able to produce the 81st show, is a governor at the Academy now, all of this stuff. But what, I mean, honestly, I stay well clear of this stuff. I'm the fanboy, I'm the nerd. A lot of this stuff I'm only aware of because of my proximity to him. What it's become, even honest, within the last 5 years, what it's become, and you get a taste of it at Toronto, the reductive quality of everything. Everything is either a racer or not a racer. If it's a racer, what category will it race in? What categories will it race
in? They have names for it? They call them racers?
That's what I call them. And honestly, for me, there was a magical little moment when it just clicked into place. I think I was hiking uphill in Runyon Canyon when it all just dawned on me that this has really become sports. Some people, by the way, who are sportscasters in this game are heavily into sports, and so during the weekend on Twitter, you'll watch them effortlessly shift from talking about the best supporting actress race to whatever game is on, and then on Monday, they're right back on who the five likely nominees are for cinematography. Some people have no interest in professional sports. This is their professional sport. These people are all sportscasters, you know? And it literally is, it's a six-month season that goes from September to February or March.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully it's not...
It's unbelievable.
It's never been my beat as a writer, because it all drives me up the wall.
I have no interest in
it. But there's so much more ink spilled is, you know, figurative, because it's more pixels. You know,
advertising sold.
To it. But the funny thing about it is, it doesn't make us any more likely to remember a year later who
absolutely
won Best Supporting
Actor. No one ever can. And if you go out to dinner, if you go to a dinner with Tom O'Neill, Sasha Stone, Chris Tapley, Greg Elwood, David Poland, Jeff Wells, Scott Feinberg,
throw in Steve Pond. He's
Dave Carger, Steve Pond. If you go to dinner with all of these people and have the Norman Rockwell dinner table, who's cutting the turkey, and then just start chucking out who won what for what. And some of them, there's always a savant. And by the way, if Bill Condon has a chair at that table, he's the savant. In 1964, he'll tell you right away, Pete Hammond is another savant. But so many of these people, they can't remember because, again, at the end of the day, who got nominated, who didn't get nominated, who won, who didn't. None of it matters 10 or 20 years later. You know what matters? What's playing on HBO?
I know.
That's what matters.
123 is where you're going to bleep him.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. What matters is that Field of Dreams is playing on HBO. How many nominations or wins or critics wins? How are the reviews for? No one cares.
Right.
And Bullworth, which got whatever it got, and I only remember that because it was a movie that was racing around the time of Gods and Monsters. Bullworth doesn't exist. It doesn't exist.
It's funny. I do remember. I was once taken out to lunch by a publicist who does a lot of campaigns and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of gave him one of my jokey stock lines, which is, you know, oh, would you rather be on the list of, you know, Kubrick and Hitchcock and all the cool people that never won one, or do you want to be on with Kevin Costner and Mel Gibson? And he goes, yeah, but Kubrick and Hitchcock really wanted one.
Says who?
Maybe.
It says him.
Who knows?
The thing is, I think that the reason that a lot of this stuff happens is I think that for a lot of people, if nothing else, it's a means to an end. It's, you know, because unless you're Lassie Hallström, you know, they think it's going to help them get the next film made, or it's going to, you know, cement their legacy or
it
whatever.
Doesn't.
It does become the first line of your obituary. So, you know, but it's too late to do you any good. You know?
I got told a few years ago that I had to be on the Gold Derby.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which also gives you an honorary membership in the Golden Raspberries Award, which we've also enjoyed this past year.
Who's the guy who does
Tom O'Neill?
Okay, so
but Dave wouldn't update his every week.
I didn't update. Yeah. I put my thing like my editor was like, okay, you need to be on Gold Derby this year, and they want you on, and I was like, okay, I don't know anything, and so like I did it, and I just put names. Didn't even like think because I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know anything, and I'm always wrong.
Yeah,
and Claire Denis is never nominated, and so like I just put in the names, and then I didn't understand that I was supposed to constantly play with my list.
Wow,
I was supposed to constantly
with each passing week figure out who was ahead.
I was supposed to wait things and unweight others and shift them around and you know, strategize. Well, okay, well now the race is getting interesting over here with this person. And I got an email, I don't know who from at Gold Derby, and they said, you haven't updated your list at all.
Get out.
So we don't think you should really be here anymore. Right. And I was like, what am I supposed to do? Right. And they emailed me back and they're like, you were supposed to keep updating and changing and moving around your list. And I was like, I don't. How?
You were lucky to get the one list.
I don't know anything. Like, and so I switched a few things around.
Just to play ball.
And I thought, okay, here are my new ideas about this thing that I don't care about, except other than that I get to eat wings and snacks and talk about the outfits. Like, it's not interesting.
I won't.
Thing to me, like it was when I was a little kid. It was kind of fascinating, but
I think a lot of
I'm little, no longer on Gold Derby.
A lot of little.
I was supposed to be on it last year.
And they were like, no right.
And I even emailed them. I said, my editor wants to know if I'm going to be back on Gold Derby, and they never responded to me.
Yeah, you blew your big chance. No, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with the Oscars. I think it's a common thing for like little.
It's a little hobby. Gay boys. It's a little gay boy hobby.
But then you get old enough, and you start seeing all the nominees in a given year because, you know, when you're 10, you don't get to see the R-rated movies.
Of course not.
And then you start seeing the movies of that year that didn't get nominated, and then you start working backwards and seeing all the old films that didn't get nominated or that did, and you suddenly realize, wait, this is ridiculous. This whole thing is a waste of time. And but it, so much attention
still
going to
watch
it.
So, well,
totally watch
again,
it all the time.
I'm not going to directly quote here, but let's just say someone very close to me said somewhat recently that for them, all the joy has just been sucked out of it because with all of these websites now and trade papers like Variety and the Hollywood Reporter, what used to just be Variety and the Hollywood Reporter and whatever unbelievably insane advertising revenues they were able to suck out of the studios during award season has now multiplied into 10 toadstools that have all come up after the rain overnight around the base of the tree. And all of these websites, all of these bloggers, prognosticators, sportscasters, whatever you want to call it, and all of these massive advertising dollars that are sloshing around out there from the studios to these sites, including therap.com, which I'm sure we'll get the first glossy rap magazine in the mail next week or the week after, along with our Deadline magazine, the actual weekly THR
variety. We love therap.com. It employs Alonzo Duralde so much.
The point is, there's so much of it now that where's the fun? Where's the joy? There, for the person I'm quoting, it's like there's just none left. Because, again, it's a six-month sports season with all of these advertising dollars at stake. And so all of these people making a living, making little piles of cash or not little piles of cash off of this stuff, you know?
And just, I mean, for all the money that studios shell out for this, I mean, do they get
in the pursuit of this, all trying to influence, and somebody else said to me, all this research that's been done of very best degree possible. I think last year there were two market research studies commissioned. One of them was commissioned maybe by the reporter, and another one was commissioned by another source, trying to determine, obviously, I mean, all the guilds and the HFPA who award the Golden Globes, et cetera, are all separate bodies, and or the Screen Actors Guild is a larger body, obviously. But let's face it, when you get right down to it, what everyone is chasing with these unbelievable sums of money is 6,000 Academy members, roughly 6,000 Academy members. And allegedly, what was told to me is all this research basically shows that these Academy members, none of them are reading this or that blogger. Anecdotally, you can hear, well, this person reads Jeff Wells, this person reads David Pullen, this person reads Greg Elwood, this person reads Chris Tapley, this person reads Sasha Stone. These Academy members. But really, the 6,000 Academy members are not, as a result of this market research, which I have not seen, this is only told to me by, shall we say, a very powerful person working in publicity. These Academy members are not influenced by these sites, these sportscasters, these prognosticators. They're just not. But the studios are whipped by the talent to spend the money to chase the tinsel.
My question is, what are they getting out of it in the back end?
There's very little basis. Only winning Best Picture, and that's not even consistent. Some pictures where they've earned the bulk of their what ends up being their cumulative gross before the win don't see a bump. Some pictures do see a bump as a result of winning Best Picture, but really only Best Picture statistically over the years, and I'm sure again there are half a dozen gnashing bloggers right now. I'm thinking of David Pullen specifically, who will chart out.
Probably doesn't listen to this show.
After I have Facebook and Twitter tweet this
maybe
thing.
Maybe he will.
But if you talk to Condon, who knows as well as anybody, really only picture and sometimes actor or actress affect the ability to actually sell movie tickets at movie theaters to real folks. None of the rest. So are those wins chasing? Yes, but at what cost? You can definitely make an argument that one reason Disney showed the Weinstein brothers off the lot was that, again, they were spending exactly how much to make Cider House Rules and then how much to market it during award season. The numbers are insane.
Can you get Bill to do me a favor?
And do your favorite musical?
Next time that he's nominated for an Academy Award. Because he will be some other time.
Yeah, right.
He's got one already. There's no reason why he won't be nominated again.
Okay. From your lips to God's ears. Yeah. Because that's all that matters.
Okay,
getting that next nomination.
Next time that happens, just for my entertainment, I would like for him to take out an ad in some big trade and write a letter to God asking for an Oscar.
Right.
Please make him do this.
Right, right.
Tell him Dave White really needs you to do this.
Please, please, please let me get what I want, Dave White.
Do a Margaret Avery.
Yet another Smith's reference.
All right, we got to talk about Carrie, and then we're done because we're about to hit the 90-minute. We've hit the 90-minute.
No, well, Carrie and Kill Your Darlings, and then we'll do the other stuff later.
Why don't we talk about Kill Your Darlings next week after I've had a time to see it?
Okay, right, because it's going to expand wider.
Fair enough.
In New York or LA, go see Kill Your Darlings. It's awesome, but we'll talk about it more next week.
All right, so Carrie sucks. The end.
Carrie, it's not even that it sucks. It's that
Ken Pierce's first movie since Stop Loss.
Stop Loss
at Paramount.
It does not.
With the lovely and demure Ryan Phillippe.
I like Stop Loss. I know a lot of people.
I never
were not
saw
fans.
It. Despite the presence of the lovely and demure Ryan
Phillippe. I found it really powerful. I'm a fan of hers, and I kind of thought the idea of her doing Carrie was interesting because she brings a certain kind of feminist perspective to her work.
Definitely.
And so I thought, okay, well, great. Then let's see what she got because certainly
she's as good a director as any.
Absolutely.
For that material.
And one of the things that people will occasionally level at Brian De Palma is the notion of him being a bit of a misogynist, maybe,
right,
you know, or at least kind of afraid of women.
Right.
But this movie feels, I mean, it's not like to Gus Van Sant level, but it really kind of feels like a fairly direct remake of the De Palma movie. To the point that, now, is Lawrence D. Cohen Larry Cohen? Or is that, are they two different people?
Well, that's an interesting question.
The Lawrence Cohen who wrote the original Carrie is credited as a co-writer here. And so,
well, don't you think that's a Writers Guild thing?
But the thing is, it feels like it's his script. I mean, Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa is the other writer on it. But really, apart from like some references to YouTube and homeschooling,
Alonzo Duralde?
Yeah, yes, sir.
This is another thing I do on Team Jack. Lawrence D. Cohen is an American screenwriter from the IMDb, who, although hardly prolific, thanks for that editorializing, has worked with some of the most respected names in the genre. He first came to prominence in the 1970s when he penned the screenplay for Carrie. His next writing project was the John Irvin film Ghost Story, based on the Peter Straub novel.
Then he adapted
Stephen King's It for TV.
So he's not Larry Cohen.
And then he did...
It's Alive, Larry Cohen?
Stephen King's Stephen King's The Tommyknockers, also for TV, directed by Tom Holland. And then recently scripted a fourth Stephen King adaptation, The End of the Whole Mess.
So Lawrence Cohen did It.
He is not Q Quetzalcoatl Cohen. Yeah,
but Larry Cohen did Salem's
It's Alive.
Lot and Salem's Lot, though, right?
No, that Toby Hooper directed Salem's Lot.
But did he... Right
I don't think he wrote on Salem's Lot
maybe
either,
not. No. Anyway, but okay, so Lawrence E. Cohen is not Larry Cohen. Good to know. So it really just kind of feels like they're going through the motions of doing the 70s one again.
Right.
And to sort of middling effect. Chloe Grace Moretz, I think, is a terrific actress. I don't buy her as a wallflower.
Right.
She's too pretty.
Right.
Sissy Spacek...
she's too forceful.
Yeah.
She's such a strong... presence. I mean, you were like I don't know how old she is now, but the minute I first saw her on screen, I thought, okay, so this is one of those little girls that freaks people out.
One of those fannings.
With how grown she is and how, like, self-possessed.
So you would have to say that although she's the element hit girl who got the studio excited and probably greenlit the package, she is miscast.
Yeah, as Carrie, I think so. Because Sissy Spacek could play both sides of the fence, you know. She could be like all withdrawn and weird, and then blossom the way the character has to do. There's nowhere for her to blossom to except that she combs her hair and puts on a nice dress.
Yeah,
And when she's carrying out at the end and killing everyone, she's like waving her hands in the air, like, now I am going to manipulate the air to make you die, and she's owning her power.
It's very Magneto.
Sort of X-Men, interesting. Yeah. That's sort of an interesting thing that she's doing. And
Julianne Moore I like a lot, but
But come on, she looks crazy in Repose in this character.
Piper Laurie.
You know she's going to be
nailed this thing. You know, and
she at least camp?
No. No, she's being very straightforward. I mean, she's taking it seriously, and she needed
a gay male director for that.
She has moments that I think are really effective, but overall, you just kind of think about Piper Laurie, and her sort of crazy religious ecstasy.
Although, let's remember, Alonso. Overall, no one in that theater this weekend, with the exception of you two queens, thinks of Piper Laurie, because no one in movie theaters this weekend has even heard of Piper Laurie.
But I bet they've seen the original Carrie.
You'd probably be horrified. What they have seen is American Horror Story, which is just camping.
I suppose so.
You know what I mean? So they do have some...
I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, if this was your first exposure to Carrie, would it... I don't know that it would have that lingering impact for people whose first Carrie was the Brian De Palma one. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
This will come and go.
It will definitely come and go. And the other teenagers are so nondescript.
Right.
I mean, you think about, like, people, you know.
William Catt,
PJ Souls, and Nancy Allen, and Amy Irving.
John
Travolta. In my rap review, I quoted Norma Desmond. They had faces then. Yeah. You know? These kids all.
They all became movie stars.
Yeah, absolutely.
To some degree or other. I mean, William Catt became the greatest American hero, and I took that. That was fine by me.
And there you go. And PJ Souls, you know, the cult icon. One of my favorite interviews
Rock and Roll High
ever.
School, right?
I adore her. So you could have put any of these kids in the Vampire Diaries. I wouldn't know them apart. You know?
Well, that, I hate to say, is to me feels reflective of the modern, you know, with aesthetic. Some exceptions, but the modern studio movie thing where the studio is owned by a conglomerate and everybody who's in there is sort of a very bland
test market
hopeful corporate product.
Yeah.
Although,
you know, one thing I was thinking was just in watching her, Chloe Grace Moretz, sort of navigate the high school stuff in this movie, and also coming off of the only good thing in Kick-Ass 2 was her navigating the high school stuff.
Right.
I was thinking, like, somebody needs to write her a Heathers or a Mean Girls or some really juicy high school thing, because I think she would just be amazing with that.
Well, it is interesting, though, compared to, or relating to Carrie, and do you remember the bad sequel that was done sort of 10-12 years ago?
Yeah.
MGM has never really stopped trying to put the paddles on Carrie and bring her back up.
No, our
likewise, friend. Heathers, which is now, I think, in workshop as a musical here, finally. But I mean, the Heathers TV thing that was done, that was going to happen for, I think, Bravo or something, that was just announced recent, you know, within as being abandoned by a name. Dave Boy, can you look that up? Heathers TV project, because there was a name.
Heathers TV project.
Person on top of that.
Well,
Heathers, they can't stop trying to figure out like how we dig up Heathers.
Our friend Brian Fuller wrote a made-for-TV remake of Carrie for NBC in the early ooze. It was actually a backdoor pilot.
Wow.
Because in that version, Carrie and Sue Snell survive and like basically go on the road. And
okay.
I think they were going to sort of, you know, go solve mysteries and use telekinesis or something.
Right.
What do you want to know about the Heathers TV thing?
Well, we know it's not they pulled the plug on it, but who was it?
Okay.
Who was attached?
I'm pulling up IndieWire for my information.
Product placement. Just more disgusting ad dollars coming over here to the Dave Webb Duralde from IndieWire.
We're swimming in coins.
The check is in the mail.
Jenny Bix.
Jenny Bix, who...
Yeah, Mark Rizzo.
She did Men in Trees.
Yep, and she also was on Tilda.
The plan was to pick up 2 decades after the film, with Veronica returning home to Sherwood with her teenage daughter and dealing with the Ashleys, a new generation of mean girls made up of the daughters of a few of the Heathers.
And
but since most of the Heathers died...
Dave White, who was paying for this? Who paid?
I don't know.
Bravo.
Yeah. Okay.
There's only one Heather died.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Heather Chandler.
Yes.
You're right.
Corn Nuts.
Right.
You're right.
BQ.
Right.
All right, we're done.
Yes.
We are done.
Jack, this has been amazing.
I'll come back anytime.
You are...
Since I no longer have a podcast...
Stop.
...at teamjack.com.
Stop.
And iTunes and smodcast.com. And plus, I totally enjoyed your... the fact that you actually can just play out a song at the length that you did at the open, because Kevin Smith's first piece of advice to me was, we don't use more than 7 seconds of anybody else's intellectual property.
Well, that's a change, because I remember when he and Mosier started, they had music playing behind them the entire time.
Then I think they heard from the attorneys.
Probably so, yes.
Yeah.
I guess if we made any money off of this, it would be that a could be different. An issue.
And my opening theme music is pretty kick-ass.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't compete. Who could compete with Earth, Wind, and Fire? Come on.
So it's teamjack.com, and on Twitter you are Jack
underscore at Jack underscore Morrissey with 2 R's and 2 S's. Facebook.com, the real Jack Morrissey. At team underscore Jack. We're on Tumblr. We're on Pinterest. We're on their illustrated episode guides for not one, but both Team Jack episodes that feature Alonzo Duralde and Dave White. I think it's probably been done retroactively.
Cheesy tater tots.
No photographs of you, but lots of Google image stuff from whatever we discussed. Yeah.
Yay.
So, yeah.
So you're always welcome, sir.
I'll come back anytime. I had a great, great time.
Well, thank you.
This has been very, very dense, which I enjoy. Well, there's so much information.
We like to get inside
going back and forth.
A ton of movies that open this weekend, but in very limited release, so we'll get to them next week. But
I'll tell y'all all about I'm in love with a church girl.
Oh, yeah.
I'm in love with a church girl, executive produced by God.
Yes, he gets a credit.
Really?
God gets a credit. In
wow.
The,
So, you'll have that to look forward to next
week. I hope
he
gets residuals.
Also, the documentaries God Loves Uganda, Bridegroom, and the Young Beats saga, Kill Your Darlings, starring Daniel Radcliffe and Dane DeHaan and Michael C. Hall.
Listen to all these other podcasts that we've told you a million times to listen to. And
how do we find you on Twitter?
We are at Linoleum. We are at Linoleum Cast. You can like our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can check into the show at getglue.com. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a good review because it helps other people find us. You can also stream us at Stitcher Radio and thelounge.com.
What about your personal Twitter?
What about it?
I'm at A. Duralde, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E, and Dave is at D. Leland White.
That's right.
Maybe I'll re-add you guys. I think I had you. I think I have one or... I'm not sure I have both of you.
I think you follow
I really first. Cut back depending on what are your tweets and how are your tweets. And are they interesting or are they not interesting to me personally? And if they're not, we all have to have the ability to check in and out of each other's. I had a seasonally unfollow, meaning award, seasonally unfollow like half a dozen people.
I never take it personally.
A month ago.
I'm following you. You're not following me, you jerk.
All right, Dave. But Dave, try and keep it entertaining.
I try real hard.
Look at your game, girl.
What is it again, Dave?
D. Leland White.
All right.
I tweet all about the variety of snacks that
I've who can argue with that, really?
Eaten.
I brought snacks to I brought snacks. Shane,
I mostly tweet about
Shane
snacks.
Morrissey the first time I did the show, and I got looked at like I had brought leprosy over.
What snacks did you?
Well, as it turns out, you did bring leprosy.
what snacks did you bring?
A variety of delicious things.
You don't like delicious things, though. Or is that what's happening?
You were trying to keep weight off or take more off.
Well, you're looking sharp.
Well, thank you.
Angular.
I am coming back here in about a month's time for pumpkin waffles.
There you go.
All right. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do
it. We know you're doing it.
Whatever I do.
You've made promises on air now.
Pumpkin, it's going to be waffles or pancakes, but whatever it is, waffles or pancakes, they will be pumpkin.
Right. Because as my grandfather used to say, in this household, all the pies are pumpkin.
That's right.
Who can argue with that?
Jack Morrissey, you're a swell. Thank you for being here.
I'm swollen.
We will catch you guys next week.
Goodbye.